listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. It was a leaderless movement based on consensus decision-making, radical egalitarianism, prefigurative politics, and a series of mass occupations that involved thousands of people. But it's not the obvious guess, the Occupy movement, but rather a set of movements in the late 1970s and 80s, many of them directed against nuclear power and nuclear weapons. While the names the Clamshell Alliance and Livermore Action Group are only known to some now, the politics of these movements left a deep imprint on subsequent forms of protest and struggle. For the second part of our look on the activist and political influences on the Occupy movement, I'm joined by Barbara Epstein. She's a scholar of social movements and chair of the History of Consciousness Department at UC Santa Cruz. Her classic book on this important precursor movement, Political Protest and Cultural Revolution, Nonviolent Direct Action in the 1970s and 80s, was published 20 years ago, but she's kindly agreed to come in and talk about the movements and what we can learn from them today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's just start with a definition. When we talk about the nonviolent direct action movements of the 70s and 80s, what exactly are we talking about? What movements?
Well, the movements that I looked at were three movements within a larger terrain, essentially, of movements that were opposed to nuclear power and to the nuclear arms race, and that hoped that opposition on those issues would lead to a broader movement for a nonviolent egalitarian society. So the idea was that these specific struggles would lead to a revolutionary movement, but a revolutionary movement conceived in nonviolent terms.
And what were the characteristics of these movements? What sort of features did they tend to embody?
Well, each of them wound up focusing on the tactic of civil disobedience and the use of consensus. All of them were informed by a perspective that blended feminism, anarchism, environmentalism, and an overall insistence on egalitarianism and the building of egalitarian community. Nonviolence was not understood exactly as pacifism. There were people in the movement who were pacifists, but I would say for the majority of people in all of these movements, pacifism was not a commitment to never using violence. It was a preference. And it was a view that in the United States, nonviolence is a far preferable tactic than the use of violence for building mass movements. And of course, it was also a vision of a future society, which would be hopefully as nonviolent as possible.
And people tended to organize themselves. I mean, you mentioned consensus politics, that's one part, but these movements also tended to organize themselves through a particular interesting structure, which was imported, let's just say, in the 1960s from the case of the Spanish anarchists of the 30s by Murray Bookchin, the anarchist writer and activist, around affinity groups. What are affinity groups? How did they work in these movements?
The way these affinity groups worked was that in each of these movements, at the center of the movement were small groups of people that worked together on particular projects, often outside of the context of the movement, but that came together to form this movement and formed its decision-making structure. And so what that meant was that, in a way, the center of the movement was the civil disobedience actions, in which often hundreds or thousands of people would commit civil disobedience, be arrested, and then there would be a time spent in jail. And the way in which decisions were made, both leading up to that action and in jail, was that the affinity groups would get together. They would make decisions. They would have spokespeople. The spokespeople would form a spokes council, and every decision would be relayed back and forth between the spokes council and the affinity groups. And the idea was that everyone's voice should be included. Everyone should be involved in decisions. And the form that is still used in the Occupy movement of voting for a proposal, standing aside, or blocking it was used in these actions. My impression, by the way, was that it either worked wonderfully or terribly. There was not very much in between.
So we'll talk more about the specifics of these movements themselves. Most famously, at least nationally, the Clamshell Alliance here in the Bay Area, the Abalone Alliance, the Livermore Action Group, many listeners, in fact, probably involved in some of the West Coast variants of these movements. But where did they come out of? When one thinks of the history of the left in this country, in the two waves of sort of left ascendancy in the 20th century, the 1930s, the 1960s, 70s, the ways that people organized and the kind of politics that they tended to have during those moments was quite different than and this sort of politics, which strangely enough, right now with the Occupy movement, people seem to think has just come out of nowhere. And yet, of course, as we will be discussing and are discussing, has actually quite a long history going back decades. But how do we understand these movements, which were based on nonviolence, based on consensus politics, based on a notion of prefigurative politics of creating the new within the shell of the old? How do they relate to the more traditional left, and how did they come about?
Well, you could think of these movements as having been formed by the younger brothers and sisters of the people who were involved in the movements of the 60s, particularly the late 60s. And these were younger brothers and sisters who were a bit critical of what their older siblings had been doing. Some of them had actually been involved in the movements of the 60s, and had essentially fled the focus on violence, or at least violent rhetoric, of the late 60s and early 70s. Some of them had moved to the countryside, formed communes in the countryside. There was a streak of the movements in the 1960s that I would say was implicitly anarchist, that didn't usually didn't use that term, but in fact was drawn to prefigurative politics, in other words, trying to form communities that prefigured the kind of society that we would like to have, and that were very much oriented towards the building of egalitarian communities. It was those people and younger people who looked at the sectarianism, celebration of violence, the celebration of third world militancy, and said, we want to build something different. So I think that was essentially the center of the movement. Now, in some of these movements, and this was particularly true in the Livermore Action Group, there were also broader circles of people who were involved. There were religious people who became involved. There were people of older generations who became involved. A part of what was useful about the stance of nonviolence was that it made it possible for people to be involved in the movement who were older than their 20s.
What was the relationship of these movements to the counterculture?
I would say that they were, these movements sat at the intersection between the counterculture and the what we thought of as the political left in the 60s. In the 1960s, there was a pretty sharp divide between the counterculture and the political left. It was a little bit fuzzier in the Bay Area than it was elsewhere, but generally speaking, you were on one side or the other. And what was interesting about these movements was that the people at the center of them were firmly on the left, but also very much influenced by the counterculture. That was particularly true, I would say, of many of the women. Women and a sort of anarchist version of feminism played a major role in these movements.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics of the movements. In 1976, in New Hampshire, a movement was born in opposition to plans to build a nuclear plant at the coastal town of Seabrook. And this was called the Clamshell Alliance. What were the origins of the Clamshell Alliance? Who made it up, and what kind of politics did they have?
I would say that there were three groups, if you could call them that, that came together to build the Clamshell Alliance. One was people who had moved from the, who had been involved in the movements of the 60s, had moved from the cities to the countryside. There was a collective called the Montague Farm that was very much involved in building the Clamshell Alliance. Secondly, there were older members of the older Quakers, members of the AFSC, who...
That's the American Friends Service Committee.
Who moved to the coast so as to be involved in this, and who played an important role and brought the conceptions of nonviolence and consensus decision-making to the Clamshell. And then there were the people who simply lived in the towns that surrounded the area, surrounded Seabrook, and who had been upset about the possibility of a nuclear plant being built in their neighborhood. Ultimately, actually, there was a fourth contingent, and that was, as the movement spread, people in Boston organized to contribute to it and began to play a major role.
And what was the scope, ultimately, of this movement, which ultimately was not successful in preventing the
right.
the plant from being built, but in fact brought thousands of people together in opposition to it.
Right. Well, there were two occupations of the site. One of them was, they were very carefully staged. The first one involved only local people. I think there were 18 of them. They were all arrested, of course. The second one involved 180 people. The organizers talked about the power of 10. And that involved people from other areas as well. And then there were plans. Then there was a much larger one. The much larger one, I think, involved something like 2,400 people. If I remember correctly, about 1,400 of them remained to be arrested. And they were taken off to two large armories where they spent a couple of weeks. And this gave wonderful publicity to the anti-nuclear movement. So then the next question was, it was clear that there was real mass involvement and mass support for this effort. And the question was how to push it further. The issue became that the authorities had caught on to what was going on. And it was clear that if even larger numbers of people were to try to occupy the site, they would find that the gate was locked. This set off a debate within the movement about the issue of violence and nonviolence, with a group of people in Boston called the Hard Rain Collective.
And violence here being
violence
defined
here
as property destruction?
Well, yes, except that it's a little more complicated than that, because the people who, the Hard Rain Collective, which was arguing for cutting the fences, said, well, you know, that's the only way that we can get into the site. And besides, any serious movement needs to take on the police. The people who were opposed to that were not necessarily against destruction of property, but they pointed out that if the fences were to be cut, it was obvious that the police would then attack the protesters. And they said that the knowledge that there was going to be violence at the demonstration would severely cut down on the numbers of people willing to participate, outside of the principled issues involved of leading people into a situation where they would confront violence. So the issue was really not violence against property as a form of violence. It was the question of a kind of violence that was designed to provoke the police and that would lead to violence against protesters.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and my guest is social movement scholar Barbara Epstein, author of Political Protest and Cultural Revolution. And we're talking about a precursor to the Occupy movement decades ago, in fact, which involved tent cities, mass actions, consensus-based politics, and prefigurative politics. The movement of the Clamshell Alliance and the events in opposing this nuclear power plant in Seabrook led to real fractures within this model of creating this community which would prefigure a future society. And you're starting to explain how that came to pass, mm-hmm. a real division that fractured the movement around a strategic question. What were the consequences of that?
Well, there was a very bitter split in the movement. Essentially, it led to the end of the Clamshell Alliance. What happened was that there were heated and bitter debates about the question of fence cutting and of what nonviolence consisted of, what violence consisted of. Ultimately, what happened was that the governor made a proposal to the steering committee that a demonstration be held at the site, and that the clamshell agree that everyone would leave after a certain point. The leadership of the Clamshell Alliance then disregarded consensus. And
when you say the leadership, isn't this a movement that wasn't supposed to have
leaders?
Yes,
ostensibly this was a movement without leadership. Everybody knew that, in fact, there was leadership. And this, by the way, was there were many people in the movement, even in Boston, who were uneasy about the proposal for cutting fences, but on the other hand, didn't like the fact that there was leadership and saw the Hard Rain Collective and the people who advocating fence cutting as the as being marginalized. Their voices were not being heard, and supported them out of a desire to include them rather than out of a genuine support for their politics.
And when you say the actual leadership, are you talking about people who were not officially leaders but ended up playing a role of leadership?
Well, I'm talking about the people who had founded the Clamshell, most of whom lived on the seacoast, had been involved in running around the country trying to form a national movement, and also had been identified by the press as good speakers, charismatic people, and so forth, and were essentially the unofficial leadership of the movement. And these were the people who were on the steering committee. The other problem was that those people and the people who lived on the coast had always thought that this struggle was essentially their struggle, and that the people in Boston were supporting their struggle. The people in Boston thought that this was their struggle. So the organization and the relationship of different groups had not been worked out. So what happened was that the steering committee responded to the governor's proposal. They agreed to it. They agreed to it without consulting the people in Boston. So they broke consensus. The result of this was extremely bitter feelings within the organization. That demonstration was held, but the result of this was that the Clamshell Alliance ceased to exist, and bitter feelings persisted for a very long time.
So while the Clamshell Alliance was not successful in blocking this plant, and as you say, ultimately fell apart